voting at the trial of House Trevelyan, the Lioness of Azal, and Isandre de la Courcelle's cool face, her downturned thumb signalling death. "My lord," I said to Drustin, my voice sounding as if it belonged to someone else, "Fauchleda of the Briganti conspired against the crown. It has been proven. We do not bid for clemency." There was a buzz around the hall. Not everyone there had known who I was, had heard Cruinia from my lips. Drustin ignored it, looking fixedly at Fauchleda. "For your treachery," he said, "you will die. For the blood ties between us, I grant it will be swift." What I expected, I don't know, again. Somewhat else. Truly, I'd not put thought to this day to prepare myself for it. Lionette accepted poison, drinking it off at one draught and laughing. Baudouin chose to fall on his sword. Is it more civilized that way? No. In the end, it is the same. Death at the root. All the ritual in the world does not change that. And yet I was shocked when two of Drustin's Cruinia seized Fauchleda's arms and forced her to her knees, when Drustin himself rose from the throne, drawing his sword. It flashed once. He'd honed it keen for this day, and there is a great deal of strength in the folk of the Culloch Garum, for all that they are not as tall as those who came later. Clean through, he severed her neck. Fauchleda's head rolled a little, eyes still open. Her body fell heavily to the flagstones of the Hall of Bryn Gorridum, blood pooling at the neck. I caught my breath in my teeth, repressing a squeak, Eloa be thanked. Jocelyn's hand closed on my elbow, bone grindingly tight, and I was glad he was there. At the throne, Nectina and her daughters looked at the headless body of Fauchleda of the Briganti, grim satisfaction on their dark, serene faces. To their right, the twins grinned with fierce vindication. "Let it end here," Drustin said softly, cleaning his sword and sheathing it. "Those who will swear fealty may live. The lands of the Briganti I declare forfeit, and give unto the keeping of the Sigilve and Votadei, who alone among the Tarab Cru kept faith with the Culloch Gorum." There was cheering at that from those wild northern Picti who'd ridden to join Drustin's army. A wise choice, it transpired, a popular choice on Drustin's part. It restored honour to the folk of the Red Bull. The Black Boar reigned in Alba. All exiles carry a map within them that points the way homeward. I looked to the east, the open windows of the Hall of Bryn Gorridum carrying the scent of rain, and a salt breeze from the sea that mingled with the coppery odour of fresh-spilled blood. A warm breeze, summery. How many months had we been on the road, at sea? In Terre d'Ange there would be flowers blooming, fruit trees bearing. I heard in my mind Telesis de Mornay singing the exile's lament. The bee is in the lavender, the honey fills the comb. The Scaldi would be massing, moving, crossing the Carmelines, fording the Rhenus River. While we waged a war, summer had come. The affairs of state that remained would not be settled in a day. Days on end it took, while Drustin heard petitions from tribal lords and common folk alike, dispossessed by Melkon the usurper, and restored to them their rights and lands. Nor was he idle on our behalf during this time, but it took some doing to rally an army willing to dare the crossing, to convince them that it was in the interest of Alba to defend D'Angeline's soil. And, of course, with the kingdom new settled under its rightful leader, it was needful that sufficient numbers remain to enforce Drustin's rule, held in his absence by Nectina. In the end it was determined that some 3,000 foot soldiers and 400 horse would make the crossing. To my surprise, Aemon and Gronia and half the Dalriada would be among them. The others would return west to Innisclan, bearing word of victory and bidding Rouse's waiting sailors to turn the ship homeward. "I have come this far," Aemon said stubbornly. If the harpists in Tiamur sing of our deeds, they will not sing of how Eamon Mac Connor of the Dalriada ran home rather than get his feet wet. Grainne, his sister, gave her lazy smile. And I am minded to see the land that breeds such folk, she said, her grey-green eyes glancing at Quintilius Rouse, who coughed to hide his blush. She looked at me and winked then. I repressed a smile. One could not help but like the twins. Elder brothers, blessing or no, the crossing would be difficult, especially with the horses. Poring over maps, Rouse and Drustin decided it would be best done if we marched south, to the point where the straits were narrowest. It would take us through the lands of the Eidlach Orr, who had proved loyal. They would cheer Drustin's triumph. Ella were willing, we would make landfall in northern Azal, in Trevallion, where we could make contact with Guillain de Sommerville, and perhaps the former Duke de Trevallion, if Mark's recall from exile had been successful. If not for the fears that gnawed at me like a canker, it would have been a pleasant journey. Alba is a fair green isle and bountiful. It was an old Tiberian road along which we marched now, in a long snaking train, along the eastern coast and to the south. Those were the areas in which the armies of Tiberium had gained a solid foothold, until Cinel Rú united the tribes and pushed them back across the sea. Blessed Eloa was still wandering in Bodistan, and no master of the straits had ruled the waters then. From whence, I wondered, had that enigma come? I remembered Alcuin in Delaunay's library, ancient scrolls and codices spread across the table, pondering, his quicksilver mind trying to tease out the heart of the riddle. If he'd learned aught before he died, he'd not had time to tell me. I wished he were here now, that I might ask him. Having once seen that terrible face moving on the waters, I'd no wish to see it again, and I misliked trusting to the promise of a mystery. One of my fears, not the least of them, I feared for the Cruinia, 3,000 warriors on foot, 400 mounted. It was not a great number, not sent against the hordes of Scaldi. I had seen them fight, and they were fierce, fierce and undisciplined. Cinel Rú had ousted the Tiberians through sheer numbers, once the tribes all rallied to fight under the banner of the Culloch Gorum. But the numbers favoured Voldemar Selig, and Selig had studied the tactics of Tiberium. Whether or not the Scaldi would follow orders, I doubted. Remembering the fractious tribal rivalries that pervaded the encampment at the Althing, I could well imagine it would be hard to maintain the iron rank-and-file discipline that had made ancient Tiberium such a formidable foe. That was one point in our favour, albeit a small one. Selig still had the numbers, and the allies of Cumlach. So I brooded as we marched, each glorious day that dawned hastening my unease, the warm balm of sunlight serving to remind me of time's swift passage. "Will you take it all upon your shoulders, Fedra?" Jocelyn asked me quietly one day, jogging his mount alongside mine. How he knew my thoughts I don't know. I must have been wearing them on my face. "Can you slow time or shorten the road we travel?" I was reminded not long ago not to take upon myself that which is not mine to carry. "I know," I said, sighing. "I can't help but worry. And the Scaldi. Ah, Eloa, you've seen them. If the Cruinia are riding toward death, they're doing it at my word, Jocelyn." He shook his head. "Not yours, Isandra's. You but carried it for her, and 'twas their choice, made freely." It may have been the Queen's word, but I spoke it, and did all in my power to persuade their choice. I shivered. The Dalriada wouldn't be here if I hadn't. None of them would.
True.
To his credit, Jocelyn said it without his usual wry twist.
But Drostin rides for love and a pledge. Love as thou wilt, you cannot gainsay it.
I'm afraid of this war, I whispered it. What we witnessed in Alba. Jocelyn, I never want to see the like again, and it will be as nothing to what awaits us in Terre d'Ange. I don't have the strength to face that much death. He didn't answer right away, gazing forward, his profile in clear relief against the green fields.
"I know," he said finally. "It scares me too. There'd be somewhat wrong with us if it didn't, Fedra."
"Do you remember waking up in that cart after Melisande betrayed us?" I asked him. He nodded. "I could have died then. I wouldn't have cared. Hating her was the only reason I had to live for a while." I touched the diamond at my throat. "I don't feel the same now. I'm afraid of dying."
"You remember Gunter's kennels?" He gave me the wry look. "Hating you kept me alive then, when I thought you'd betrayed me. If you'd asked me before, I'd have sworn I'd kill myself before I endured such humiliation. And Seligsteading? You shamed me into living."
I remembered shouting at him, shoving him where he knelt, wounded and chained and flushed. "I was desperate. Are you going to do the same to me?"
"No," Jocelyn said, though he grinned as if the prospect wasn't entirely displeasing to him, which gave me a strange sensation, a fact I kept to myself. "They are," he said, twisting in the saddle and nodding to the rear. "That's what I came to tell you, actually." I turned to look.
Rouse's men were marching behind us. There weren't enough horses to mount them. They'd fought on foot. They marched in formation, four columns, six deep. The Admiral, his legs still healing, rode alongside them. As I watched, the foremost row grinned, and one man, Remy, who'd taught Hyacinth to fish, stepped out in front, carrying a tight-wound standard. The others in his row shifted, so they formed a wedge. Fedra's boys, he'd called them. Atop a wide-barreled chestnut gelding, Quintilius Rouse chuckled. Remy unfurled the standard and held it aloft with a clear d'Angeline shout, letting the banner snap in the breeze. They'd made it themselves. Sailors are great tailors. Where they begged the cloth, I don't know. I heard later the gold thread cost them dear. It was a sable banner, bearing a ragged circle of scarlet at its center. Crossing the scarlet, a golden dart, barbed and fletched. It took me a moment before I realized. Kushiel's dart.
"Oh, blessed Eloa!"
I stared, then remembered to close my mouth. Grinning like a monkey, Remy pounded the foot of the standard on the road and began their marching chant. All of them took it up, even Quintilius Rouse, roaring along with the refrain, half unintelligible with laughter.
"Whip us till we're on the floor. We'll turn around and ask for more. We're Fedra's boys."
"Oh, no," I laughed helplessly, numb with shock and hilarity, and infinitely thankful that the Cruinia, who regarded the proceedings with good-natured bewilderment, didn't understand d'Angeline.
"Eloa, Jocelyn, did you know about this?"
"I might have," he admitted, an amused glint in his blue eyes. "They need to believe, Fedra, to fight for something. A name, a face they know. Rouse told me as much, and I've seen it too in the Brotherhood. We can't become companions, not truly, until we're pledged to a ward. These men have never seen Isandre de la Courcelle. You, they know." "We like to hurt, we like to bleed. Daily floggings do we need. We're Fedra's boys."
"But," I asked, still laughing, "like that?" Jocelyn shrugged, grinning.
"You sang the seas calm, and you drove the Dalriada to war, whatever it took. They know that. That's why they adore you. But everyone needs to laugh in the face of death. They're following an Anguisset into battle. Give them credit for seeing the absurdity of it. You've been dwelling on it long enough."
"I'll give them more than credit." Turning my horse, I cantered back a few paces and dismounted in front of Remy with his standard, bringing the line to a halt. He hid a mischievous smile. I reached up and grabbed his auburn sailor's queue, tugging his head down to kiss him. He came up from it wide-eyed and gasping. The d'Angelines cheered and shouted. "Any man who survives," I said to them, remounting,
I swear to you, I will throw open the doors of the 13 houses of the Night Court."
They cheered at that, long and loud, then took up their chant again as I rode back to rejoin Jocelyn and the column began to move.
"And how," he asked me, "do you propose to do that?"
"I'll find a way," I said, light-hearted for the first time in many days. "If I have to take an assignation with the Caliph of Kebel-i-Makkad, I swear I'll find a way."
So we marched through Alba, through the lands of the Trinovanti and the Kantike, as summer wore on, the grain turning from green to gold in the fields and apples swelling on the bough, until we reached the old Tiberian settlement of Dobria, where the straits were most narrow. It was a clear day when we arrived. We paused for a moment atop the cliffs, the high white cliffs of Dobria, before riding onward to the beachhead some miles away. The green sward goes right up to the edge, and then they drop away sheer, down to the straits, only seabirds wheeling between with harsh cries.
"There," Drustin said, and pointed.
Faint and distant, across miles and miles of grey water, we could see it. Terre d'Ange. Home.
Chapter 75. The folk of the Eidlach Oar had been busy. Drustin had sent his fast riders ahead, bearing word of our need, and Alba had responded, eager to obey the restored Cruach. Boats of every ilk, small one-masted ships, oar boats, scows, fishing boats, rafts, they had them ready in abundance. A vast and motley flotilla filled the harbour, awaiting our arrival.
"This is going to be ugly," Quintilius Rouse muttered, casting a practiced eye over the assembled vessels.
It took nearly 2 days coordinating the arrangements. The Cruinia sailed, but only along the coast. Precious few had ever crossed deep water. Fedra's boys were spread thin, sharing their precious expertise. The Dalriada were valued second, who had sailed fearless between Alba and Era. We quartered the horses as best we could, though only a few of the ships had holds designed for it. Others would cross on rafts, blindfolded. If they panicked, Rouse warned, let them go rather than capsize. Somehow, amidst it all, an ancient Alban fisherman wound his way through the crowds, plucking at Drustin's cloak, peering at him with a wizened face.
"Lord Cruach," he said tremulously, "you tell them, do not fish the deep waters. 3 spear casts off the coast, that's as far as they may go. Aught else is the Sea Lord's hunting ground."
"I'll tell them, Grandfather," Drustin said politely. "But you needn't fear, we're not here to fish, and the Sea Lord has sworn us safe passage."
"Tell them," the old fisherman insisted. "Culloch Gorham to the north and west, you don't know. The Eidlach Oar, we fish these waters, we know."
"I will tell them," Drustin repeated.
He did too, addressing the army as we stood massed on the shore, some third boarded with the horses, the rest awaiting his order. A short speech, the wind off the sea whipping his words away.
"We cross now to follow a dream of 2 kingdoms united. We cross now to honour a pledge that I made long ago, to Isandra de la Courcelle, who is queen of Terre d'Ange, that lies over the waters. Does any man or woman among you wish to turn back, do so now, and do it with my blessing. I ask no one to risk death for this dream, this pledge. But do you seek honour and glory beyond countless bards' telling? Follow now and find it."
They cheered him for that. His face glowed.
"This I tell you. The Lord of the Waters has sworn us safe passage. We shall reach the other side. I have done it before, and I know. These waters are his territories. Respect his sovereignty, and harm no creature. What do you say? Will you dare the crossing?"
They would, and said as much, shouting and waving arms. The sound echoed across the harbour. A party of northern Picty, the loyal Tariff Crow, raised their voices the loudest, attempting to blend in with the crowd and disguise the fact that they came late, racing from hurried farewells with some of the more eager women of the Eidlach Or. Still glad enough to have allies among the Red Bull, Drustin overlooked their tardy arrival.
"Then let us go," he cried, and the exodus began.
Quintilius Rouse was right. It was ugly. Even with the horses already boarded, it took nearly an hour before the last man was aboard, and our ungainly flotilla began moving out of the harbour. Rouse had commandeered one of the better ships, which would bear Drustin Mab Nectina, as well as Hyacinth, Jocelyn, and I, who were of no help at sailing. We would be safe for all of us, with the Admiral, than anywhere else. It would have been a comical sight, I imagine, in less serious circumstances. A small continent's worth of ill-matched vessels moving awkwardly across the water. Leaning over the side, I watched one of Fedra's boys shout at a hapless group of Kruinya, attempting to drive a raft with oars, their uncoordinated efforts sending it spinning in slow circles.
"Azal has a fleet," Quintilius Rouse muttered, seeing the same thing. "Mayhap 'twould be better if we crossed alone and sent the fleet back for them."
"Azal's fleet may be halfway up the Rennes River, my Lord Admiral," I reminded him, "as might your own. But if you think it best, give the order now, before anyone founders." He looked dourly at the struggling raft. Under the Dangeline sailors' frantically gestured orders, the Kruinya got the knack of it and began moving forward.
"Let 'em try. I'm not minded to cross the straits more than once, unless I need to."
I couldn't blame him for that, not after having seen the master of the straits. I'd no wish to risk seeing him again either. And in truth, once we got under way, a strange thing happened. The winds held, light and steady, blowing off Alba's shore toward distant Terre d'Ange. The winds held, but the sea grew calm, scarce ruffled by the breeze. Our fleet strung out in a ragged line, lurching forward, slowly and surely. The shore fell away behind us, white cliffs looming, receding yard by yard, until the yards became a mile, and 1 mile, two. The Albans didn't lack for courage nor hardihood. Set to an unfamiliar task, they laid to it with a will, hands calloused by sword hilts wrapped around oars, backs bent to the task. Here and there, across the water, Dangeline voices arose in a rower's chant, marking the time, adapting the words of their chosen marching tune to an oarsman's beat.
"Man or woman, we don't care. Give us twins, we'll take the pair. But just because we let you beat us, doesn't mean you can defeat us."
Other voices took it up, Kruinya and Aaron alike, meaningless syllables mangled in foreign tongues. At the helm, tacking slowly to keep pace of the fleet, Quintilius Rouse shook his head and grinned.
"Never been anything like it," he shouted. "This crossing will go down in history, I promise. And elder brother bids fair to keep his word."
He jerked his chin as Hyacinth.
"What do you say now, Tsingano? Care to point our way to landfall, eh?"
Hyacinth stood in the prow, gazing out at the smooth waters, wrapped in his saffron cloak, now salt-stained and travel-worn, and gave no answer. With a frisson of alarm, I made my way to his side. "What is it? What do you see?" He turned his face to me, black eyes blurred with the Drummond, wide and unseeing.
"That's just it. I can't see our landing."
"What does it mean?" Hyacinth looked back at the sea.
"It means," he said softly, "that somewhere between here and the far shore lies a crossroads, and I cannot see beyond it." I would have asked him somewhat else, but a great clamour arose at that moment off our port bow, shouts of laughter, scuffling and blows. Such was the noise of it that all of us who were idle on deck went to look, even Hyacinth, forgetting his fears. It was one of the small rafts, with some 14 of the Tariff Crow.
Sycophay tribesmen they were, and a single Dangeline. Without enough oars to go around, three of the northern warriors had disported themselves by lying at the edge of the raft and peering into the clear, still waters, thrusting their arms into the sea and wriggling their fingers, attempting to catch fish barehanded. A good trick in riverbeds, I am told. It shouldn't have worked at sea, nor would it, save for one very large, very curious eel, which one of the Sycophay had caught round the middle with both hands and hauled onto the raft, thrashing like fury. It was that eel they were trying to subdue, with shouts and flailing blows of oar and fist, and Rouse's sailor yelling out helpful directions in incomprehensible Dangeline, the raft rocking wildly. I think we all laughed for a moment, until one of the Sycophay caught the eel a good pounding blow on the head, and it shuddered and became still, wet and gleaming on the raft, a full 5 feet or longer. And the wind went dead. And I remembered what the fisherman had said. The Tariff Crow came late. They hadn't heard Druston's warning, and the Dangeline sailors wouldn't have understood. He'd spoken in Cruinia. I hadn't translated it. They had their orders from the Admiral. They knew what we were about. 3 spear casts off the coast, aught else is the Sea Lord's hunting ground. We were 3 spear casts and farther. We were miles at sea. In the sudden absence of wind, it was as if the world had drawn a deep breath and held it. I did the same. Before, the master of the straits came with gathering darkness and lashing rains, driving toward us across the waves. This time, it was different. This time the very sea itself erupted. In the midst of our motley fleet, the waters boiled, boats and rafts tilting on end, passengers crying out and scrabbling for a hold. And from the maelstrom the vast face arose. Those vessels closest slid one way, plunging down the enormous slope of the form's streaming hair. Those on the outer circle, as we were, tipped the other. For a moment, I swear, the ship nearly stood on her prow, awash in a sheet of water. Somewhere, Quintilius Rouse was roaring orders, inaudible over the rushing sea. I clung grimly to the railing, both hands locked in a death grip, and vowed to Eloa that I would light a candle for my old tumbling master if I survived. A man's figure slid across the steep slant of the wooden deck, his desperate shout cut short, disappearing in the foaming sea. Up and up, taller and vaster than I remembered, the face of the master of the straits arose, transparent and shining, with the flicker of living fish and bits of weed glimpsed in the water that shaped his features. Then he held and rose no further, and the seas fell level with a thunderous clap, our ship crashing back on its keel. The impact jarred my grip loose. I was flung half over the side, the railing catching my midriff. All around the surging waters, our impromptu fleet bobbed like corks on a flood, holding a half-drowned army, horses screaming in panic, some already swimming, churning and terrified.
Phaedra!
A strong hand entwined in my tangled cloak, hauling me back on deck. Jocelyn, soaked to the bone and wide-eyed with shock. I looked for Hyacinth and saw him safe some yards away, where he'd been swept. And then I had no time to look for survivors, for the master of the straits spoke. Towering as high as the cliffs, it seemed, glistening and huge, his face rose above us, and the terrible maw opened to loose the thunder's voice.
Who hunts my seas?
I know what I know, what I saw, what I heard. I would swear it. The master of the straits spoke Dangeline. I heard it, Hyacinth, Jocelyn, the Admiral, we all did. But the eel-catching Tariff Crow on the raft below us cried out in terror, at the same moment that Druston Mab Nectina, the Kruark of Alba, stepped forward on our now steady deck, unfaltering despite his lurching gait.
"They are my men, Sea Lord,"
he cried in Cruinia, straining his neck to stare up at the master of the straits.
"I failed to warn them. I am to blame."
The face looked down, water streaming from on high.
"You lead. all burn.
Quintilius Rouse, swearing, abandoned the helm to come forward.
"'Tis my ship, and I command it, you old bastard. If you've come to take a toll, take it from me."
More than anything, I did not want to leave the safety of the railing, Jocelyn's hands holding me anchored, secure, out of the notice of that awful water-wrought face looming above us, more than anything. With a sinking feeling of despair, I murmured to Jocelyn, "Let be." His grip tightened on my arms, and I turned to look at him. He bowed his head and let go, and I stepped away from the rail, raising my voice to the towering seas.
"My lord, I am the emissary of Isandre de la Courcelle, Queen of Terre d'Ange."
The face of the Master of the Straits turned my way, water cascading, shaping a fluid mockery of flesh and bone. Lightning flashed in the eyes, the dark mouth opened.
"I will take you all."
For what happened then, I lack words. The face flowed, dissolving, shaping the vast glassy hump of a wave. Flowed and flowed under our ship, lifting it. We rose on the crest of it like a toy boat, and the wave surged forward. It surged and did not break. Like a charging bull, it rushed down the straits, unending, unbreaking, and our ship borne atop it, bearing us southward. There are those who doubt, but I swear it is true. Mile upon mile we travelled, twice, thrice the length of our crossing, longer mayhap. How long it took, I cannot say. Terror gave way to wonder, then a slow mingling of despair. Were all behind us drowned, I could not help but fear so. Onward and onward we rushed, the great wave never breaking. Until, at last, an island rose before us, thrusting bleak and lonely into the sea. Closer and closer the wave brought us, still riding its crest, and I saw no inlet, and thought we should be dashed to death against its tall grey cliffs. There, at the final moment, I saw it. A narrow harbour carved in the rock, ringed by high walls. It was toward that we sped. At the mouth of the harbour the great waves sighed and flowed backward beneath us, the deadly crest receding to a gentle slope. Our ship slid down it, easing between the high cliff walls, and whether Quintilius Rouse had aught to do with it, I cannot say, but that wave deposited us in the small still harbour, as neatly as a cat laying a mouse at its master's feet. I was afraid it was an apt comparison. Sodden in places, salt stiff where clothing had dried, and lulled into near paralysis by our fearful passage, we began to gather our wits, shaking off the awe and looking about. There were 30-some of us on the ship, mostly crewinia, with 8 horses in the hold. It was one of Justin's men who saw it first, pointing with a sharp cry. A promontory of rock jutted into the harbour. Steps terraced and smooth led down to the water. Above were more broad steps, cut into the cliff face, leading upward. Behind us nothing but the harbour walls and open sea, empty. I glanced up to where, high above us, columns rose into the sky, distant and foreshortened, for all the world like a Hellene temple. The sky was grey, and the white marble of the columns blurred against it. But that wasn't what had caused the crewinia to point. Standing on the promontory, 2 robed figures awaited us. Chapter 76.
"I will go."
It was Drustin who spoke first, quick and firm, his dark eyes resolute in the blue mask of his face. I remembered how he had stepped forward, unhesitating, to take the blame for the Tariff Crow. One could not help but admire him, and realize his worth to the folk of Alba.
"No, my lord,"
I shook my head, feeling the mass of my hair wind-blown and heavy with sea-water. What would my loss cost Terre d'Ange? A nation at war had no need of one rather travel-worn Anguissette.
"We are near d'Angeline shores. It is my place to go."
While we argued in crewinia, Quintilius Rouse peered over the edge of the ship, gauging the open water that lay between our vessel and the steps, mindful of the fact, which we ignored, that no one was going anywhere until it was bridged. The taller of the robed figures came to the edge of the promontory, pushing back his grey cowl to reveal himself a young man with dark hair and unassuming features.
"The waters are deep, sirrah," he said in a calm, carrying voice, speaking in archaic Dunsheline. "Bring your ship in close, and thou mayest lower a plank."
"Hear that?"
Rouse turned around, snapping his fingers at the closest crewinia, who stared uncomprehendingly at him.
"Go on, to oars. We're bringing this ship ashore."
The Admiral turned his best glare on me.
"Whatever's in your head, lass, no one's going in alone, Queen's emissary or no. So tell these wild blue lads to bend their backs, and we'll see what game Elder Brother's playing at."
I did, feeling a little foolish. Drustin gave Rouse a deep look and went to the stern to survey the seas for any sign of our missing fleet. If he could buy the Alban's safety with his life, I thought, he would still do it. But Rouse was right. We didn't know why the Master of the Straits had brought us here. "What do you see?" I asked Hyacinth, as the oars dipped raggedly and the ship drifted close to the terrace. He gazed at the cliff wall, the broad steps, smiling strangely.
"I see an island," he murmured. "What do you see, Fedrano Delaunay?" To that, I had no answer, and in short order the ship came alongside the promontory, and Quintilius Rouse gave word to drop anchor.
The gangplank was lowered, but none of us disembarked, standing instead on deck and awaiting word from our strange hosts. The second figure drew back his cowl, an older man, white-haired.
"Those among thee the master wishes to see," he said,
in the same archaic Dunsheline dialect his companion had used. I spared a quick glance at Drustin and saw him frowning. He did not understand the words. The old one pointed, unerring.
"Thou, thou, and thou, thou."
Drustin, Rouse, myself, and Hyacinth. Jocelyn stepped forward, and his daggers crossed and flashed as he gave an armed castelline bow.
"Where she goes," he said softly, "I go. I have sworn it in Carsiel's name."
"Violence will not avail thee," it was the younger who spoke, smiling faintly. He nodded his dark head at the sea, and it rippled in response, our ship rocking.
"Thy companions are safe, on First Sister's shores. Willst jeopardize their safety?"
I translated quickly, and Drustin caught Jocelyn's arm, understanding.
"My folk, my people, he says they have them safe, brother. I beg you do nothing to bring them harm."
Jocelyn did not release his daggers as I gave him Drustin's words, though his knuckles grew white with strain.
"To damnation and beyond," he said.
His voice was faint, his expression terrible.
"I have sworn it, Fedra."
The lives of 3,000 and some innocent Albans and near all of Rouse's men stood at risk.
"Jocelyn," I whispered, "I will kill you or myself before I let anyone else die for your vow. I swear it."
He looked at me. What he would have said, I don't know. The older of the robed men lifted his hand and spoke, forestalling him.
"He is companion sworn," he said to the younger,
who bowed his head, acceding.
"Let him come."
Drustin watched the proceedings intently, dark gaze darting from face to face. I translated, and he nodded, releasing his grip on Jocelyn's arm.
"Gildas will take thee to the Master of the Straits," the younger man said. "I will see to the others. Thou art weary and fearful. We offer rest and succour."
I repeated his words to Drustin, who nodded again and spoke reassuringly to his men. It was decided. So, I thought, as we disembarked, crossing the gangplank, our footsteps sounding hollow above the water.
"The Master of the Straits has servants, and mortal ones. Do they wield his power to ruffle the waves, or merely speak his command?"
The face of the waters spoke, and all understood. "These men speak Dunsheline, the old tongue of courtly lays." These things I thought as we mounted the steps, climbing upward into the skies. Gildas led, Raus and Drustin behind, the young Kruach's misshapen foot causing his pace to slow somewhat as he scrambled from step to step. I followed, Jocelyn stuck to my side like a tall castling burr, while Hyacinth trailed behind us. I would have spoken to him, but his shuttered expression forbade it. Behind us we heard the reassuring clamour of the remainder of our party disembarking, the skittering hoofbeats of frightened horses on stone, the babble of voices trying to communicate in foreign tongues. We climbed and climbed, mounting into the sky. It was a vast temple at the summit, and no mistake. A broad path branched to the right at the foot of it, but further stairs awaited us before, steep and narrow, wrought of white marble. My breath grew thin and came in gasps, and I'd been living hard, riding with the Kruinia. I heard the men and horses turn off at the branching path and envied them. Raus was panting too, and I heard Hyacinth's breath ragged in his throat. Drustin set his face with grim determination and showed no sign of fatigue, though he labored twice as hard as any of us. Jocelyn? Jocelyn was castling. He'd run miles behind Gunter's Thane's horse, through deep snow, and come out of it glaring hatred. I shook off his hand when he sought to brace my elbow, aiding me up the steps. And white-haired Gildas wasn't even winded. So we gained the temple. It is my fate, it seems, to fall privy to rare and splendid vistas in a state of exhaustion too profound to care. At the summit of this lonely isle, where columns of white marble rose into open air, like a prayer uttered to an unheeding god, I bent over and gasped for breath, fixing my gaze on the lone figure at the center of the temple. He was tall and robed in grey, like the others, yet unlike, for the colour of his robe shifted under the open skies, dark and pale with the changing light, hanging motionless in the breeze. His hair hung long and unbound, iron-grey, I thought. Then it too shifted, changing colour with the scudding clouds. He stood alone, his back to us, and a great bronze vessel, broad and shallow, stood beside him on a tripod, at the heart of the rectangular structure.
"Come," Gildas said, and began to walk.
We followed him across the white marble flagstones. The tall figure turned as we drew near, regarding us with sea-green eyes, revealing a face at once ancient and elemental, mantled in iron-grey locks, a face as white as shell and older than bones, shifting and fluid, with a power in it that rose from the very depths of the ocean. I had seen the face of the waters, terrible and powerful. Ascending, no more, a thought born of a sea-rooted mind, the reaching hand of power. This was the master of the straits.
"My lord," I whispered and knelt.
Drustin Mab Nectina took one lurching step forward, locking gazes with the master of the straits. The high breeze lifted his scarlet cloak.
"Lord of the waters," he said evenly, "you gave your pledge. When the Kullach Gorum ruled in Alba, you would allow us the crossing. Why have you brought us here?"
The master of the straits smiled, and his eyes lightened to the colour of sunshot mist.
"You were warned, young Kruach," he said, and though his mouth moved, the words seemed to arise from the very wind, echoing around the open temple. "You were warned, Alban."
A gift of tongues, the Scaldi claimed I had. Witchery. I had Delaunay for a teacher, no more and no less. The master of the straits had the gift of tongues, for I swear it, I heard the words in Dongeline, but Drustin heard Kruinia and replied in kind.
"Lord of the waters," he said sharply, "you gave warning as a hunter lays bait. Why have you brought us here?"
On my knees, I thought, mind racing. Drustin was right, the honeyed promise of safe passage, a toothless warning, easy to discard. The master of the straits wanted something of us. What? Beside me, Jocelyn's hands hovered over his hilts. Quintilius Raus stood like a bull ready to charge, head lowered. Hyacinth was swaying on his feet,
barely upright.
Why?
The master of the straits mused, and the sea wind sighed around us. He clasped his hands behind his back and gazed at the far oceans.
Why?
He turned back to us, and his eyes were as dark as thunderheads.
800 years I have ruled, chained to this rock, claimed by neither earth nor sky.
He raised his voice, and the winds lashed us, and the clouds roiled, and the seas far below beating themselves in a frenzy against the cliffs. His hair rose on the wind, standing around his face like a dreadful corona.
800 years, and you ask me why?
We braced ourselves, recoiling against the wind. Through the fingers raised to shield my face, I saw Drustin Mab Nectina leaning into it, eyes narrowed.
Why? He asked, shouting the word. Lord of the waters, you hold my people hostage. Why?
The winds died. The master of the straits smiled once more, his eyes softening back to sea green.
Alban, he said, caressing the word.
Reaching out one hand, he pointed to the gold signet ring, Roland's ring, on Drustin's hand.
You have the courage to live the dream that will free me. Your mother saw it in the dark behind her eyes. The swan and the boar, Alban and Dangeline, love defiant. But it is only half.
I understood. It was my gift, Delaunay's training, to hear the unspoken thing, to see the connections beneath the surface. I rose. My lord, I said carefully, this I understand to be true. You are bound here to this isle, whether you will it or no. You wish to break this binding. Two things are needful. One is the union of Alban and Dangeline, present in the betrothal of Drustin and Isandre. What is the other?
Ah.
He took a step toward me and caressed my face with one hand, as if he had the power to mould my flesh like water. I closed my eyes and shuddered profoundly.
One who hears and listens and thinks. That is well. You have named the riddle. Answer it in full and you may leave.
Drawing his hand back, he swept his arm across the shallow cauldron, sleeve trailing, taking on the hue of bronze. The cauldron was filled with water that rippled and stilled, reflecting not sky, but the face of Isandre de la Courcelle, who sat in a makeshift throne, the accoutrements of a war camp behind her, listening intently to someone unseen. Drustin gave a short cry, and Quintilius Rouse pressed his fist to his brow.
"Answer it in full," the master of the straits said, and smiled, and his eyes were as bleached as old bones, "and you shall have my aid in full. Fail, and the sea shall claim you."
He pointed to the western skies, where the sun sank low and red over the waters.
"One night I give you. When the sun stands overhead tomorrow, you will answer." Or die.
Chapter 77. Gildas led us to the tower, which spiralled skyward from its perch on a lower crag, down another series of broad marble steps at the far side of the temple, then along a wide paved path. We followed silently, all of us lost in our own thoughts, the setting sun throwing our shadows black and elongated before us. It lit the tower like flame, drenching the grey walls with gold, shining unexpected on aureal windows of coloured glass, rare and wondrous. The uppermost chamber of the tower was ringed all around with them, and two other tiers staggered with the plain. A pretty sight. It would have surprised me if my capacity for surprise wasn't flattened. We entered the reception hall and found a neat company of servants turned out to await us. Ordinary men and women, isle folk, I guessed them, clad in simple linens.
"Thy shipmates are well tended, thy horses stabled,"
Gildas said to us, and the stilted formality of his courtesies seemed sincere.
No harm will come to thee in this place. By thy leave, we offer the master's hospitality. Warm baths, dry clothes, wine and supper.
And the rest of my folk? Drustin asked when I had translated for him. Does this priest stand surety for their safety?
I asked in Dongeline. Gildas bowed, grey robes swishing, remaining grey, unlike his master's.
First sister lies thence, he said, pointing in a southerly direction, some 3 leagues. She is rich in kine and fowl and cider, and thy folk have been brought safe to her shore. Do thou no harm here, and they shall be well. On my head I swear it.
With that, Drustin had to be content, and Quintilius Rouse as well, whose sailors were with the Cruine, your host. "Will the Master of the Straits dine with us?" I asked Gildas. He shook his head.
"Nay, my lady, each other's company will you share."
"You serve him." I eyed his robes, at odds with the simple clothing the patiently waiting servants wore. "Are you his priest?" He hesitated at that.
"'Tis true we fill the bronze bowl with sea-water, Tillian and I, once at sunrise, once at sundown, and betimes we may speak as his voice when it is needful. Thus are we privileged to serve, but we cannot break the Geas who are born to the 3 sisters.
I remembered the bronze bowl on its tripod, shallow but vast. Twice a day they must descend those interminable steps down to the sea, returning with it brimming, thrice today because of us. No wonder he had not gotten winded. The binding upon him, it may not be broken by one born to the isles? Another pause, then Gildas inclined his head a fraction.
As thou sayest, wilt honour us by accepting our hospitality?
Yes, I said, since there seemed little point in declining, and thank you. For he had handed me, unwitting, the key to the riddle, although he took it as thanks for the hospitality, as I meant him to do. So I thought, that is that. How it fell out with the others I cannot say, but I was led up the winding stair to a sumptuous chamber. 3 house servants were my guides, a young woman and 2 of middle age, quiet and demure. I do not suppose there was much gaiety involved in serving the master of the Straits. The rooms were gorgeously appointed, and I, raised in the night court, do not say such things idly. The bed itself was a marvel, ebony posts carved in fantastic forms, the coverlet of velvet tasseled in gold. The bath was of solid marble, and the ewers in which they carried heated water were silver. "From whence does this come?" I asked curiously, undoing my brooch and setting aside my salt-stained cloak. The youngest maid, undoing my stays, caught sight of my mark and suppressed a gasp.
"From the bounty of the sea's floor," one of the older women murmured, pouring steaming water into the bath.
"Shipwrecks," I thought, shedding my clothes.
They whispered in awe.
I realized then what was different. Peasant stock, these isle folk, so one doesn't expect too much. Dongeline, they spoke, but if the blood of Eloa and his companions flowed in their veins, it was nowhere evident in their features. No, they were purely mortal, earth-born and bred, with none of the odd outcroppings of gift or beauty that marked even the lowest-born of Dongeline peasantry. Eloa had loved shepherdesses and fishing lads alike. He'd not scrupled at peerage. That was a human construct. But Eloa and his companions had set no trace on the bloodlines of these folk. And then I climbed into the bath and forgot such concerns. There is no situation so dire but a hot bath cannot improve one's outlook. So I have always found to be true. And I have never been ashamed to revel in luxury. Not since my contract with de Morban had I been treated as I was accustomed. I gave myself up to it without a second thought. Soaps and perfumed oils they brought, combs and scissors, until I was utterly and thoroughly pampered, cleansed of sea-crossing, hard-riding, war and its labours.
I could live like this, I thought. Then I thought of the Master of the Straits and shuddered. They brought clothing when my bath was finished, old-fashioned and gorgeous. The bounty of the sea is floor. Whose trunk, I wondered, had held the gown I chose? It was a bronze satin, rich and shimmering. The neckline worked a handspan deep with seed pearls. There was a hairpin, too, with a spray of pearls that fastened at the crown of the head and twined into my sable locks. Yes, I admired it in the mirror, a weighty affair of dark glass, gilt-edged and massive. What would one expect? A foot-servant came then, bowing unobtrusively, to escort me to dine. The dining hall was one of those set about with oriel windows. A long table shone with polish, set with plates of silver and white linen cloths. The others had already been summoned. Quintilius Rouse caught his breath when I made my entrance.
"My Lady Phaedra,"
he said, bowing and extending his arm. We had all, it seemed, received the same treatment. The Admiral was positively resplendent, in a russet coat and a brocade vest, his white shirt spilling a froth of ruffles down his broad chest. Hyacinth wore a doublet and breeches of midnight blue, pewter slashes showing at his sleeves. I'd not seen him out of Tsingani gaudery. He looked every inch a young nobleman, albeit with a melancholy cast. Jocelyn wore black, reminding me with a pang of Delaunay in his austerity, a chain of square-linked silver glittering on the placket of his doublet, his fair braid like a mark down the centre of his back. His castellan arms made an odd addition, although he'd forgone his sword. I dare say Drustin cut the strangest figure among us, in a black silk shirt with a ruffled cravat, moleskin breeches of charcoal grey, and a coat of deep red velvet. His face, marked with the blue whorls of a Cruinia warrior, seemed an exotic affectation. And yet, in a peculiar way, it became him. I curtsied, they bowed. Quintilius Rouse escorted me to my chair, and we dined. We dined very well in the castle of the Master of the Straits, with darkened windows around us, served by his staff with downcast eyes. We dined and spoke little, until the plates were cleared, and a bowing servant set a tray with a decanter of cordial and five glasses upon the table. Rouse poured.
"So,"
he said, taking a drink and smacking his lips, setting his glass on the polished wood with a solid thud, glancing around with his keen blue gaze.
"We've a riddle to solve. Shall we pool our wits and put to it, then?"
No one answered. I took a sip of cordial. It burned sweet and agreeable in my throat. Glass in hand, I rose, going to one of the windows, gazing out at the dark night, the invisible sea below. What had Delaunay trained me for, if not for this? To tease out the thread of a riddle and unravel it. They spoke the tongue of ancient ballads on this isle. I leaned my brow against the window, feeling the glass cool and smooth against my skin.
"You know."
Soft-spoken words in Cruinia. I did not turn to look at Drustin Mab Nectina, but nodded, moving my head against the glass. I had read a thousand ancient tales in Dangeline, in Cerdici, in Scaldi, in Cruinia, translations from the Hellene, which I had scarce begun to master. I knew. These things have a pattern, a structure, and I was trained to see such things. I knew. Drustin drew a sharp breath.
"There is a price."
I laid my hand on the window, seeing its shape stark against the darkness. "There is always a price, my Lord Cruach. This one happens to be worth it." He rose then and bowed. I turned around to meet his eyes.
"Know that I will pay it if I can."
There was naught else to say, so I nodded once more. Drustin twisted the signet ring around his finger, dark eyes holding mine, then left.
"What did he say?"
Quintilius Rouse asked, bewildered.
"By the 10,000 devils, I thought we were here to resolve a mystery."
"Ask Phaedra," Hyacinth said, his voice hollow, raising his haunted face.
"She thinks she has solved it. Ask her.
and see if she will speak."
He slid his hands blindly over his face and let them fall helpless. "If this riddle is mine to answer in full, then I will," I said softly. His pain tore at my heart. "Don't begrudge me that, Hyacinth." He gave a choked laugh, then stood unsteadily.
"Would that Delaunay had left you where he found you. I rue the day he taught you to think."
I'd no answer to that, either.
Hyacinth made me a mocking bow in his best Prince of Travellers style, the slashes in his sleeves flaring eloquently. Quintilius Rouse scowled at his exit, shaking his head.
"I like this not at all," he growled, picking absently at a tray of sweets. "If you've an answer, lass, share it. Let us put our heads together, that all may benefit."
"My Lord Admiral," I said, "no. If Anarfiel Delaunay found this answer, he would not share it. Nor can I. If you come to it on your own, so be it."
Quintilius Rouse muttered something about Delaunay's folly. Jocelyn moved, restless, coming to stand next to me, hands clasped behind his back, gazing out upon darkness.
"I'm not going to like this, am I?"
he said quietly. I shook my head. "No." He stared at the unseen sea until I laid my hand upon his arm. "Jocelyn." He looked at me then, reluctant. "Since the day you were assigned to ward me, I've been a trial to you. A thousand ways I've strained your vows, until your very brotherhood declared you anathema. I swear to you, I'll only do it once more." I cleared my throat.
If we must part, you must abide it. You were trained to serve royalty, not the ill-conceived offspring of Night Court adepts. You swore your sword into Isandra's service. If you would serve her, protect Drustin, promise me as much."
"I cannot promise it."
His voice was low.
"Promise me."
My fingers bit into his arm.
"I do Carsiel's will. No more can I swear."
It would have to be enough. I could ask no more than I would give. I released him. "Even Carsiel bent his will to Elawa," I murmured. "Remember it."
"Remember, you are not Elawa," Jocelyn said wryly.
Chapter 78. I did not sleep well that night in the Master of the Straits' fabulous four-posted ebony bed. My heart and mind alike were too full. Once I rose, opening the door of my chamber onto the tower landing, candle in hand, gazing at the closed doors of my companion's sleeping quarters. I would have gone somewhere, to someone, then, but I knew not whom. So I returned to my vast, lonely bed and dozed, tossing, waking in a tangle of linens. I wished Delaunay were here. Day broke and wild onward. I found the library that housed 100 books believed lost, pages thick and stiff with their drowning, ink blurred, but still readable. There was a whole volume of poems by a famous Hellene poetess that I had never read entire. Maestro Gonzago would have given his eye-teeth to see it. I read slowly, trying to translate the words into D'Angeline, wishing I had pen and paper. They were beautiful, so beautiful I wept, and forgot where I was, until Tillian came to fetch me. Noon was nigh. They led us back along the broad, winding path. Strange how familiar it seemed. The Master of the Straits awaited us in his temple, open on all sides to the breezes. I never understood before how sacrificial victims could go consenting. I thought of Elawa bearing his palm to the blade. I thought of Yeshua taking his place upon the wooden tree. No two sacrifices are the same, and yet all are in the end. It is the commitment to belong, wholly, to that which claims one.
"Have you an answer?"
the Master of the Straits asked, and his voice rose like the wind all around us. His eyes the colour of sunlight reflected on water. I shivered. Enough of a coward, it seemed, after all, to wait on another's response. None came. "Yes, my lord," I said, my voice sounding small and mortal.
I raised my eyes to meet that sea-shifting gaze. One of us must take your place. I heard Hyacinth laugh despairingly. The master of the straits looked at me with eyes full of thunderclouds.
Are you prepared to answer in full?
Jocelyn drew a long, hissing breath, his hands flexing above his daggers. Quintilius Rouse made a startled sound, and Drustin bowed his head, twisting the signet ring on his finger. He had guessed. Earth's oldest children. They are closer to the old tales, to the workings of fate. Yes, I whispered. Yes, my lord.
No!
I was not sure for a second who had spoken. It sounded so little like Hyacinth. My prince of travellers so light-hearted and careless. No longer, not since Moraith's death. He gave a choked laugh and ran his fingers through his black ringlets.
You summoned me, my lord. I am here. I will stay.
The master of the straits was silent. And I knew then that everything before had been but play.
No, I whispered, turning to Hyacinth. My hands rose, shaping his face, almost as familiar as my own. Hyacinth, no!
He held my wrists gently. Breather dreamed me on an island, Fedra. Do you remember? I couldn't see the shore. The long road ends here for me. You may have unravelled the riddle, but I am meant to stay.
No, I said, then shouted it. No!
I turned to see the master of the straits, fearless in my despair.
You seek one to take your place. You posed this riddle, and I have answered. It is